Support for the Commodity Week podcast comes from Strategic Farm Marketing in Champaign with crop insurance, grain marketing, and commodity brokerage services. Learn more at sfarmmarketing.com. And by ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you. Support for Commodity Week comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333. And by ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
This is the August 19 edition of Commodity Week. One more week and the outside markets decide to tank, but in Chicago, futures finished higher. We'll try to find out why today on Commodity Week. Welcome to Commodity Week. I'm Todd Gleason. This half hour, we'll talk with Pete Manhart. He's with Bates Commodities out of Normal, Illinois. Mike Zuzolo of Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting from Lafayette, Indiana. And Dale Durkles of AgriVisor LLC in Bloomington. Commodity Week is a production of Illinois Public Media. You can find us online anytime you'd like at willag.org. That's willag.org.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Well, let's begin our commentary today with this question. Dale Durkles, when you looked at the numbers for the week, were you surprised that Chicago was able to hold as strong as it did in the face of the economic deluge of bad news coming from Europe and other parts of the world?
Well, you know, we really only had a spate of really bad news on Thursday, and we recovered somewhat that, at least in the early part of the day on Friday. And I think a lot of people were sitting here thinking about that FSA preliminary data and, you know, questioning if plantings were as large. Owen Taylor put out a corn yield estimate of 149 bushel, and so everybody was sitting there a little anxious about what is our supply really, and I think that helped support the market during the week.
Mike Zuzolo?
You know, at the end of last week, Todd, it seemed like we had a lot of good things going for us, both in the outside markets and in the micro supply-demand, and it seemed like that was probably going to try and carry through in terms of momentum. So I felt like that maybe the outside of the and the micro side were going to work together this past week because of the way the prior week ended. And so that momentum did carry through. But like Dale said, the Thursday disruption, I think, did spark some fear. And you could see that in the flat price action where the traders went back to spreading. They would buy beans and sell corn. They'd buy corn and sell beans. They didn't want to take too much risk on with just flat price buying and flat price selling, and they stuck with their spreads. And that's been one of those things that we've had to watch for 2 to 3 months. And when you look at the bean chart, you just keep seeing it in a flat to sideways trendless type market that's very volatile, but you can't really sink your teeth into it one way or the other, whether you're a bull or a bear.
And Pete Manhart.
Well, I think with the week before, when we were up 400, down 500, up 400, down 500, put a lot of stress on people, so that this week, the one day down, and then the realization that maybe the crop size is getting smaller helped us in the end, and we just had the one day of the bad news. And we did recover a lot that day, from down 22 on beans to only down 3. So I think the realization that maybe the crop size is not as big as we think it is overshadowed all that economic stuff.
You know, one interesting point about what Mike was talking about, the beans being in a confined trading range here, and I thought about this earlier in the week, and I've been in this business 35 years. Never have I seen any commodity, any grain, let alone soybeans, trade at what I'll call a moderately high price level, like between 13 and 14, for 5 months without a change. You don't find a bean market or a corn market or a wheat market get up to a moderately high price level and get stuck in a side little range and go nowhere. You're either going to go up or you're going to go down. And here beans are really stuck at a moderately high level.
Okay, let me talk about that just a bit. I don't want to talk about it. I want you to talk about it, and we can go across the board. So when does a commodity trade in a range like that for a very long time? It seems to me that it's the bottom of the trough and not the top of the trough.
You're very right. Typically, when we find broad sideways trading ranges in the grain markets, it tends to be when we're trying to build bases and bottoms historically, not at moderately high levels. And certainly the peaks, we tend to see them have spikes up and then break hard.
I think the other thing about this range, it's over a dollar. It's like a little over 14 to down to 12.80. And so people don't realize that that's really a range we've been stuck in all this time, and it is trying to build that base.
The thing this time around, it strikes me, is that how much the gold has been able to move and how much it's changed. I was talking to clients this past week about the gold, and it's kind of gained in terms of importance, in terms of if it could make a meaningful high and break back below that 1420 level, $1,400 level, somewhere in there on a weekly close, Todd, I think that would put us into a corrective mode. I think that would mean a lot more of the trade, maybe by a factor of four or five in terms of importance, because I actually think the gold, because of the sovereign debt issues, because of the currency issues, has actually attracted a lot of fund money, and it's also kept fund money out of the beans, out of the grains as well these past 2-3 months.
We talked before we started on the air about what the high prices at this point meant, and that maybe the outside markets didn't understand in Chicago what a $7 corn market really might mean. And I don't know whether producers are thinking in the same range that the three of you were discussing as we began this program. Dale, what's $7 mean?
You know, I was looking at this about a week ago, and you know, it's one of these little things that you happens and it jumps out, and I just did some simple arithmetic. The old all-time high in corn, forget about 95-96, but the old all-time high was 4. We've got a high now of 8, and, you know, and I started looking at it, and I went, you know, $7 is a new 3.5. When I looked at soybeans and looked at a simpler calculation, it seemed to me that 13.5 was the new 9, and wheat, you're talking about $9 is the new 4.5, and those $4.5 wheat, $3 plus corn, and $9 beans, anytime we got over those from a marketing standpoint in the 70s and 80s and even into the 90s, it was an opportunity to really make sales. And so I think understanding where our price levels today fit in that scenario really helped producers out there to understand where the markets are at. I don't care about the outside money.
I think the producers are very well tuned in to what do these prices mean to demand. Everybody can agree. You know, for instance, we're in El Paso, and you folks were in, you know, Tuscola area, over towards Decatur area again next week. And I think by and large what I've picked up is producers buy into the idea that the supplies are tight enough to keep prices elevated. But what's going to happen to demand? And like Dale's talking about with the fund money, I don't think the investor money understands what may happen to demand if we keep going higher. In other words, we may see, well, let's put it to you this way. China has already gone ahead and stopped their domestic corn production going into ethanol. They're concerned about their pork prices. We're sitting here talking about a situation where chicken weights are going to be forced to be lower, you know, putting out mandates where chicken weights may have to be forced lower. You're seeing cattle going into the feedlots at a record amount, but then after that, you're going to have historically tight numbers. So I'm a lot more clear on the supply side, and I think the producers are too, but I think everybody's worried about demand destruction if we go another notch higher.
I think this 7 and 13 area right now, as far as that's the new 350 and the new whatever, are areas that demand will stay. But if we go too far above that, that's the worry of cutting demand. And we are going to lose a little demand as we go higher. But I think the demand can get used to that 7 and that 13 and still survive.
2 points here. First off, you know, in the bean range, and one thing I came back to and started thinking about, I think actually the corn market is holding the bean market up and keeping it from going down simply because of the price relationship. It affects what producers may or may not plant on a year-to-year basis. But even more importantly than that, it affects the relationship on the feed side of the equation, too, between bean meal and corn, and beans or bean meal are cheap relative to corn. The other point I think it's important, it's being lost on people at this juncture in time, is the wheat structure. And not wheat here in the U.S., but wheat in the world. And I think that's a huge item. You go back and you look at 1983-84 was one period where we went quite a long time where we had wheat-corn prices in current relationships at this point. We fed a lot more wheat than we did corn. We did here in the U.S. because that's where the wheat was at to be fed. This time around, it's outside of the U.S., and we have a fair amount of feed wheat. And I think one of the pitfalls we've got to be careful about is wheat's going to diminish corn export demand over time as long as this price relationship stays here.
You mentioned the poultry industry and that weights might come down, I think, from, what, 7 to 6 pounds? And there was some announcements about that in the last week. Tell me about the announcements and what you think they mean. And is that demand destruction or just demand stretching?
I think it's demand destruction in terms of the retail customer is going to have to pay a higher price. One of the things that's strikingly different to me in whether you're in China or whether you're in the United States, buying soy oil, buying pork, buying diesel fuel is the governments of the world tried to not pass on price increases to the consumers of the world. That is not the case this time around. And I think that's where the poultry industry, by limiting the weights, they realize they're going down in supplies. They need to keep their prices high. But by the same token, what happens is you have high-priced pork, high-priced beef, high-priced poultry all at the grocery store. So the consumer doesn't have that ability to switch, you know, and taste and preference becomes less and less an issue.
There's another thing that goes in that, too. You know, I mean, consumers today, when they go into the store, I don't think are really as cognizant on the price per pound basis when you're looking at meat or pork or poultry, any of the three. So they're going to go in and, what's this package of beef cost? What's this package of pork cost me? And, you know, I what's it going to cost me then to prepare a meal? And we could say the same thing for chicken. So when I look at chicken at this point, you know, I'm going in buying a whole fryer. It's X number of dollars. I don't think about it being smaller. I don't think about that actual breast that's there ending up being smaller. It's a breast. And so consumers don't really relate to that quite as quickly.
And that's also true in all the other things you buy in a grocery store.
Right.
The size of the boxes are smaller,
right,
leaving the price of a box the same instead of raising the price of the box. They're actually getting more for a smaller amount.
You're paying more per unit in it, though, but the consumer doesn't realize that.
Let me ask this question because we understand pennies per pound.
Mm-hmm.
The consumer is looking at dollars per meal probably or dollars per item, whatever it happens to be. If what you're suggesting is correct, and I think it is, does that mean that pressure in Washington, D.C. or on governments about the price of food will be lessened because consumers don't quite get that they're getting less?
That's their hope, I think.
Surely there's a reason that, you know, that the box gets smaller, but it stays the same price.
Well, that's their hope. I think this ties into what's happened in the outside markets. I feel like that if we can come out of this break in the outside markets, it's actually kind of a silver lining, blessing in disguise type argument that the emerging markets especially were getting to the point where, well, pork prices in China was already above their 2008 levels. So they were actually seeing higher inflationary pressure in some segments. And maybe this break in energy, maybe this break in the stock market cools the jets enough that in the medium term, we don't have to see these inflation fighting mechanisms come in by governments, mostly in emerging markets, not as much here. But I think your point earlier about is there real demand destruction, I think what we're three probably saying is, yeah, you may not realize it, but there is demand destruction going on and the governments are going to be sensitive to that.
I don't know that I'd use the word destruction, but let's say mitigation.
Yeah. True.
You know, we're cutting at it at the edges. And when you look at the grain markets, for example, you know, the one thing as an analyst you always have difficulty with, it's easy as an analyst or it's easy for a farmer to go out there and always look at the supply side because it's there, it's in your face, it's easy to see more often than not always the case. Demand shifts are difficult to pick up because they happen in little increments unless you have some huge circumstance, like an embargo,
ethanol,
for example.
Ethanol is a demand shift.
Yeah. But I'm talking about when you see demand start to be eroded. you don't pick up those little things because they're just accumulation of little bitty points that build and build and build. And you get about 2 months down the pike and all of a sudden, you know, markets are softer and you're seeing, oh, demand's not there. And you look back and you go, how did I miss that? It's because the shifts are so small initially that it's very hard to pick up. And you know, what we're talking about here, changing the size of poultry, for example, you know, it's just a little bit off the edge that you don't see. Talking about wheat replacing corn in feed rations out in the world starts to take the edge off of corn export demand. And so you're just incrementally biting into that a little bit. And, you know, you get 6 months down the pike and you go, wow, we did ration and demand enough to get us through.
And I think we looked at USDA's numbers of when they moved the carryout higher in this last report, and that was part of what that was from, was that little bit of less demand said we have more left. We had, what, 60 million more corn, and I don't remember what the bean number was, but they actually raised the carryout for the last year.
Mm-hmm.
So prices have been high enough, long enough, that reallocation of supplies has begun to take place. Some of that in the United States was in large part because of the development of the ethanol industry. Would I be wrong to say that? Nobody wants
Depends
to
on your time frame you want to discuss too.
Since 2001.
Well, yeah, since 2001. You know, I mean, I'm sitting here talking about, not worried about the last 10 years. I'm trying to figure out what's going to happen in the next year. And that's the kind of things we're looking at here is what's going on today and how does this play into the mix in here for the next year in the markets we have today and how do we approach those markets today?
And so you don't want to have a situation where you lose both physical demand and investment demand. You know, that's what 2007, 2008 kind of taught us, and we need to learn from that. That's, like Dale said, it's like catching a falling knife when it comes to demand erosion or a shift in demand. And all the meetings that we've gone to, at least that I've gone to, it's really been mostly about supply, and rightfully so, because that is a true concern of producers. But I think it goes back to if you get up to those levels. Well, I did a study because of the 2001-2002 time period of that Commodity Exchange Act when funds came in. I didn't go back any farther than 2002, and the big lows that were made in the middle part of the year for corn, 4 out of the 9 years have been in July. Excuse me, in August. For beans, if you add July to August, it's been 5 out of the last 9 years. So you typically have a good, strong move up or a major low in lead month futures. If you try and combine that with what Dale was talking about in 83, when we had a similar situation, our highs in 83 were in the mid-September time period. Mm-hmm. So to me, this is kind of a window where if we do go up to that next level, let's think about the demand erosion issue and maybe scale into it as far as hedging.
You know, he touched on something, and I think I'd add a comment here that also is something that's rather interesting. I think, you know, we've lost the investment crowd out of the traditional commodities at this point. You know, they have become, especially with all the volatility we've put into the equity markets now, very much risk averse. And corn, soybeans, wheat, hogs, cattle, they all are perceived to have a lot of risk in them. They're still going into gold, but gold's actually, to me, another quasi-currency. So that's a little bit different game at this point. The one interesting twist, when you look at the corn market, since the low we put in at the end of June in corn prices, and we've rallied roughly $1.50, open interest has hardly changed. No new money came into the mix in here in the last $1.50, and that's real telling on a market. It tells you that this investment money is just kind of like, we're out of here, we're staying away now.
But when that happens, do we lose liquidity? It doesn't look like we have.
It potentially makes for a lot more volatility. You give me something
but
that
we
would
get more volatility,
right?
And we lose. Okay, but we lose liquidity and get more volatility.
If you give me something, for example, and I'm just going to give a thought in here. Let's say we stay firm into the September crop report, and the September crop report, for whatever reason, happens to be a little negative. Because we've lost this outside money in a big way in the market, when you break, there's no buying underneath the market either. And so the breaks get real hard. And so you do have a lot of this volatility back and forth.
In Chicago for the week, September corn had a high of $7.20.5, a low at $6.93. It settled 9.25 cents higher at $7.11. The December contract at $6.46.75. Up 4.25 on the week. Soybean futures are 1366 high, a low at 1331. Settlement price there at 1359 and three quarters, up 32 cents. November's at 1368 and a half. They finished 33 and three quarters higher. And the wheat futures are 739 and a quarter top, bottom at 699 and a half. Settlement price there at 630 and three quarters, up 28 and a quarter. July contract at 805 and a quarter, up 22 cents. We'll catch the livestock from the CME group as well. August live cattle at 114.30, we're down $3.60. August feeders at 133.30, we're down $2.55. And October lean hogs, we're down $1.10 at $88.37.5. On Friday afternoon, Mike Zuzulo, there was a cattle on feed report. It had some interesting numbers in it. On feed as of July 1st at 104, marketed was at 100%. But placed was at 122%. That's the highest number they've had since they started keeping those numbers in 1996.
And if you talk to a Texas cattleman, it was no surprise. I talked to one of my best clients in north of Amarillo, and he said, I went to an auction. There's 1,000 head that was supposed to be for the auction, and he was over 5,000 head, all lightweight, Todd.
Mm-hmm. So they're just coming in.
It's probably one of the two last rounds, I would guess. If they don't have good planting of wheat and they can't graze wheat, you know, calves on wheat pasture next spring, we'll have another lighter round of liquidation. But this is going to be really something to have to work through in 2012, 2013, historic.
But what do you mean by that, though? What do we have to work through?
We haven't had the July 1 number for calves. I think it was the lowest since 1973, and that's as far as I could go back and get data.
All right.
So we're going to have a bubble here of lots of them and then have nothing behind it.
Right.
And that's going to create havoc.
Create havoc in both the cattle industry.
And in the feed industry.
And the feed industry. On the feed industry.
Right.
Because up front they got to have a bunch. And because those guys are all going into the feedlot at this point.
Which really says, you know, with the broiler industry contracting a little bit at this point, God forbid if we see the hog and pig report at the end of September showing a little bit of contraction because grain prices stay elevated, you really are going to see meat potential prices out in front of you maybe be very good. But, boy, the grain demand when we get into the latter part of this marketing year could really suffer.
And you're talking about second quarter of the next calendar year?
You'd probably start late winter on into spring and summer.
And how much of an impact?
Can't say until you really see numbers.
And that's a good reason why this 7 and 13 we're talking about should be taken advantage of.
Right.
And why if we look at a report in September that boosts things, if it does, we ought to be looking at doing something with
cashing
some of our
in.
12 stuff.
Yeah.
Is carry in the market telling you not? Is it telling you to go ahead and sell over the scale?
Not for me, not for the listening audience here. I would say that to a client in Nebraska, but I would not say that because I still think the basis can return back to levels like it was in mid-June, mid-July timeframe, especially in Decatur. So I'm going to wait and see. If the crop's not really there, I think the basis should react.
Yeah, I think you're right in that regard. You know, I mean, if you're talking about a traditional Midwestern farmer, you start looking out into winter and on into spring, et cetera, with again, corn crop arguably a little bit tighter, that you do say that with the carry that's there and especially on farm store grain, you know, you start looking at basis appreciation, and it looks like, you know, when you start to market, you ought to be using some hedge to arrives or something out there for late winter, spring delivery, something like that. Now, in the beans, which tend to be more flat, there's no reason to own them.
Right.
I see no reason to own corn either. If we all of a sudden get another boost up, I'm going to unload everything I've got for nearby, and I'm going to look at protecting and or having some sales for 12.
Well, he's talking about just taking advantage of some basis appreciation and carry if you have
I understand farm, that.
But everybody's in the same boat.
Right.
I'm looking at flat price. What's the flat price going to be, and that basis is what's going to do the flat
price. The difference is how we merchandise it.
Right. Yeah. But you're all on the same boat, and you're all 3 weeks out saying if the basis appreciates and you're running the combines in 3 weeks to 6 weeks out and you're running the combines, send it over the scale. Is that what I'm hearing?
In some fashion.
Yeah, and I really do like that 83 model from a standpoint. I mean, maybe, you know, the compliance people would make me want to say or want me to say you can't use past performance, and the futures market may have already got this seasonal mindset in place, but it's uncanny to see how the 83 market topped right after, you know, the Farm Progress Show and mm-hmm. before the first day of fall. I think that's a good model to start using.
Okay, so we can say that with the cattle market, with the beef cattle, and maybe somebody can give me some numbers on how much grain they actually consume with the cattle. I don't know whether anybody's got that off the top of their head. But you can say that number, when you're looking at consumption and the numbers we just got, going to fall off pretty sharply by the time we get to next year. That's demand destruction caused by drought more than anything else. Does that mean that they'll try to bring those animals back fairly quickly, though, too? Because they've still got awfully high prices.
The problem with cattle, you can't bring them back very
right.
quickly.
It takes forever.
You either got to turn to the nine-week wonder in the poultry and crank those up a lot, which I assume, you know, would crank up a lot, but still you got some limitation physically in how much you can really push that forward and how quickly. And you could probably accelerate, you know, hog output at some point out there. So, you know, but cattle would be the net loser because you still can't. You can't turn the spigot on that fast with cattle.
And you don't, from what I'm picking up, they're into two rounds of their hay cutting at this point. I mean, with hay prices where they're at and how far deep into their feed usage and forage usage they are, if they don't have a good grazing, wheat grazing crop, then mm-hmm. they're not going to be able to turn around even if they wanted to, no matter what the price, in my view.
Okay, so come back to the soybeans because I heard, I don't remember which one of you said that you were a seller of beans at this point. Who was that?
I think all of us, truthfully.
Is that everybody saying?
As far as storage, I think that, yeah, if you got to pick one over the other.
Well, I said, you know, what I said is, you know, the bean market, it's relatively flat, you know, and you really can't argue that from a storage standpoint that you want to hold beans because you don't have the carry to play the game. And especially in beans, because if you do have another large South American crop this next year, that tends to keep that game flat out through the year. Versus corn, where you have carry and you can pick up some basis appreciation, there's potential for more return by storing corn than storing beans.
Any other things on the beans?
Well, and then you have the input prices. I mean, if your input prices go sky high because USDA cuts us down below a 150 yield and you have fertilizer prices go through the roof, I think between natural rotation back to beans and input prices meaning a lot more to central Illinois and central Indiana farmers in 2012 than they did in 2011, I think you could pick up a lot more bean acres. And so that looking out a little bit farther, if I had to hedge for a reason of worrying about the outside markets, I'd go after beans harder than corn for that.
But down the road, I still think beans can be more explosive than corn to the upside because of China and because of our weather situation of what are these yields going to do. If it doesn't rain in the next 2 weeks, what's that bean yield going to do? What are those pods going to feel like? And is China going to continue to try to increase their hog population needing more meal? So I think... Yeah, I'd be a seller of beans at pretty much these prices and a little higher, but I think they've got explosive potential down the road.
You know, I looked at China in a different fashion, which I found kind of interesting back earlier in the summer. I looked at vegetable protein meal demand consumption on a per capita basis. In China, they're up over or right at 100 pounds per person. Japan's at 90. South Korea's at about 150. I think we're starting to get sort of mature over there that we got to be careful. They are not going to go to a Western diet.
That's Dale Durkles. He's with AgriVisor LLC out of Bloomington, Illinois. Also in studio with us for this edition of Commodity Week, Mike Zuzulo of Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting out of Lafayette, Indiana, and Pete Manhart from Bates Commodities from Normal, Illinois. And that wraps up Commodity Week. Visit us online if you have the opportunity. The address is WILLAG.org.
Support for Commodity Week comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333. And by ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.